Good day, Red. Welcome to another exciting and scintillating episode of the OIG Roundtable, here with my two compadres, Matt Kachansky, retired senior executive from HHS OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director, and our SIU director, and Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from HHS OIG and a manager on our SIU team. And a few people have asked us about where Jason has been. Jason took a very long vacation after having worked 45 plus years in the industry. He felt like he needed a little bit of break from the work. And so he took a little bit of a leave of absence, a very long vacation, including a transatlantic cruise and a few other things. So he's just taking a breather and probably be back in the middle of the summer. So Jason continued to enjoy that much needed time off after 45 plus years of working. We appreciate it and look forward to having you back in a couple of weeks. So I've got Wade and I've got Matt here to talk this week about press releases and some of the information that comes out in press releases. For those of you that watch our podcast on a regular basis, you know I'm fairly prolific on LinkedIn. And one of the things that I personally like to do is read press releases, ingest the information, and then kind of write an analysis of what I am gleaning from that press release. There are always going to be things in the press release that are missing or things of that sort. I just think that when we read press releases, they're always in a vacuum. But the thing that always has been a constant theme in social media, particularly LinkedIn, is that press releases we always need to understand that press releases are part of the story, not the whole story. When you read press releases, oftentimes, particularly from the SIU perspective, and as a retired OIG agent, we look at them a little bit differently. You always go, oh my God, the behavior that this provider was engaged in was really egregious. And then you read a little bit further and you realize it's a civil settlement. And you're like, how on earth was this person not criminally charged? And why is it that this was dealt with as a civil matter and not a criminal matter? A lot of times we're never going to know the answer to that because the answers are going to be contained within the negotiation, the discussion, the underlying facts and circumstances of that case. And so sometimes it's a combination of factors. It could be a low dollar amount case that the government feels it needs to still be involved with. It could be an aged case. And I'll tell you, if you read a lot of the civil settlements that are out there coming through, a lot of those are aged QTAMs. That are out there that have just taken a long time to resolve for whatever reason. But also, there are instances where a provider may enter into a civil settlement agreement in lieu of a de minimis criminal behavior because it just isn't, the juice isn't worth the squeeze, so to speak. So Wade, you know, we talk about this a lot offline. We talk about this a lot in the podcasts. And, you know, a lot of it has to do with what are some of those either prosecutorial decisions, some of them are investigative resolutions that tend to work, you know, their way through the system. And, you know, one of the things that you brought up was this whole prospect of the sweetheart deal. And I don't want to make this a political thing. And it's some, you know, every district has their own determination as to what's going to be the right course of action. And I'm using the term sweetheart. I know you used it. And I'm using it. But we're using the term sweetheart deal really just for the discussion purpose. It doesn't mean that, you know, a billion-dollar fraudster is getting a $100,000 civil settlement, but there are going to be those instances where, again, just like from the SIU perspective, the OIG perspective, it's case prioritization and it's overall case management, jury appeal, all those things. So you got to take press releases with a grain of salt, but you also got to think about, like, you know, sort of from our perspective, the investigative perspective, those backstories.
Yeah, I think you can boil it down to really two, you want to simplify it, it's really two issues. It's budget cost-wise is the big one, and the other one I think has a lot to do with prosecutors. I mean, nobody wants to lose. Agents don't want to lose a case, but that's where you get a lot of these deals where it's like, well, we, as an agent might think, you know, oh, this should be a 100 count indictment and we should hit them with all these things, and then the prosecutor might come back and say, oh, we're gonna, you know, we can count relevant conduct in sentencing. We're not going to have these huge indictments like we used to have. It's going to be a 10 count indictment. We're only going to charge for these things. And it's a combination of resources to get that case up to, you know, trial ready before you pull the trigger on it. It's got to be, you know, ready to go. So it's resources, and again, it's like they don't. Nobody wants to have, you know, counts that are not proven. They don't want, you know, they don't want to lose anything in the trial. So that's where we get these deals where you and I or Matt would look at it and say, I think they could charge, you know, these 25 counts or go into this issue, which maybe is harder to prove intent. But those are all things that take so much more resources and funding to get the case to that point. And I think that's really what it boils down to is really those two issues.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for some instances, when you're reading these press releases, you also have to keep in mind the time period of the behavior. Are you running out of a criminal statute, right, which is 5 years? Are you coming close to the statute of limitations on the civil, which is 6 years? You know, you never really see that 10-year look back piece come into play. But, and there are a couple of anomaly instances, like, for example, any cases that are linked to COVID fraud, there's a specific carve out legislation that was passed that allows 10 years for prosecution versus 5 years. But, you know, I think the part is that when people read press releases, the part that sometimes people read but maybe not understand or are able to necessarily digest is that time period. You know, I looked at a press release the other day where it was an ophthalmology case, services not rendered, medically unnecessary services, and the period of time on the ketamine was 2012 to 2016. So we're talking about a case where already we're 8 years in, and, you know, was this being looked at criminally? Were there, you know, during the pandemic, for example, did they not sign what they call the tolling agreements? There are a whole bunch of like collateral factors where at some point the government says, well, it's taken us too long to investigate this. Let's just resolve this civilly or something like that. You know, I think, you know, generally speaking, when we hear about an issue involving medically unnecessary services, everybody gets really spun up. Because a medically unnecessary service means human guinea pigs. And while there are a lot of instances in patient harm, we often see instances of medically unnecessary services which are just add-on nonsense tests. You know, like a simple one would be you go into the doctor for a sore throat and the doctor does an EKG, right? Totally, you know, non-invasive, no harm to the patient kind of a deal, just something to pump up a bill. And then you look back and you see, oh my goodness, this case was resolved as a civil matter. Why wasn't it resolved criminally? But and I think some of those factors have to, you know, come into play. So Matt, I want to go to you because Wade brought up something, the important piece from the SIU perspective, which is that the financial piece, the, you know, the whole bit. But, you know, one of the things that you brought up before we started to do this recording was this whole premise of the flip. That back in the day, we relied a lot on the investigative piece, the complaints, things of that sort. It was investigation and then relying on data, whereas today it's data relying on an investigation resulting in a settlement or a prosecution where, you know, you look at the, for example, the early days of Strikeforce. I remember when Strikeforce was starting to be exported out to other parts of the country, and we would look at the case files for a Strikeforce case, and you would find that the amount of information in the case file was what we would probably consider laughable considering prior, but is now the standard. And so it's kind of the chicken or the egg. So when you get to these press releases, maybe there's not a lot of meat on the bones because there was no need for there to be meat on the bones. Provider put their hands up and said, hey, oop, you got me, and then kind of move on.
Yeah. It's a subtle flip, but it's a flip. I mean, I admittedly dinosaur, you know, when I was doing cases, we never got referrals from the administrative contractors for Medicare. We developed them through the, you know, the individual hotline complaints or walk-ins or whatever it may be. So we started from a basic narrative allegation and then had to work it to see, okay, does this have merit? Yeah, we looked at data, but that was just to get the names and contact information of other sources. Go talk to the patients, go talk to people on the doctor's staff and things like that, building up the case that way. And then looking at the data really just to make sure, yeah, that was billed, that was paid, and here's the loss amount. We didn't rely on the data to show us where the fraud was. We did that on our own. And that's kind of flipped, and it, for good or bad. Now it's, you know, the data is dictating what is defined as bad behavior in terms of the plans, policies, and regulations. And some of those data models that we use are more and more complex and bring in very esoteric policies and regulations that, to Wade's point, would a jury care? You know, that this guy was using this code instead of this code, and probably not on a criminal matter. You know, in a criminal matter, they're going to say, no, that doesn't make any sense. So in using this data and using these algorithms and using all of this, you know, and then just supporting the data through talking to beneficiaries to make sure services are rendered. Oh, you got this instead of this. Was it this provider that saw you or this provider? That type of thing.
Right.
You tend to get cases where they're easier to settle civilly because the data is showing, yeah, there was a loss. But was it a loss due to criminal conduct or not? And that's where I don't think the investigations are going to that extent anymore, because they can get the benefit up front from getting the civil settlement. And the U.S. attorney's offices are happy because they've got civil divisions that are hungry for affirmative civil enforcement actions. Right. And the providers and their attorneys are very happy because they don't have to do an exclusion. So they're going to be able to still practice, probably with a CIA or something like that. But everybody's happy in the end with these more moderate outcomes.
You know, and what's interesting is recently we did a review for one of our SIU clients, and we found that there was a denial rate of 100%, but there was no effect on payment. It had to do with an audiologist who was using the wrong code for hearing aid. It was a hearing aid related matter. And we went back to the plan and we said, what is the reimbursement rate for this code versus that code? And they reimbursed at the same rate. And so the investigator said, well, you know, what should we do? And I said, well, in lieu of having the provider resubmit all the claims, because they'd have to do, the claims have to be re-adjudicated. You'd have to go in, you'd have to deny all the claims and have the provider resubmit the claims. The documentation actually supported the other code that they were doing. And so what we said was, make this an education piece for the provider, because it's not worth the cost of having to have the provider resubmit their claims, have the plan deny the claims, have them resubmit when there's no effect on payment. Give the provider education and training to show them, hey, your documentation is actually very good. You're just using the wrong code. Like, let's move forward on this. And I think, you know, that's a little bit of where you sometimes get that, you know, that back and forth on that, where it isn't inherently a fraud case. It can be a waste abuse case, right, or just a misalignment of information. And I think, you know, where you guys are both hitting the nail on the head is that when we read these press releases, we're not even getting the cliff notes. We have no idea what the actual fact pattern was. We have no idea what the, you know, battle of the experts might have been, particularly whenever you see medically unnecessary services. If there's no effect on the patient, it's not a patient harm issue or something like that, you know, nobody wants to have a battle of the experts on a medically unnecessary service. I mean, I know you can go and talk to a provider, particularly when you've got issues where there are multiple policies that allow you to be able to bill for this. You know, you'll see this oftentimes. I think you see it a lot in cardiology, where a provider might bill for 4 or 5 tests when they only need one test to be able to definitively come up with whatever the medical condition is. The provider's billing for 4 or 5 other tests. It's well documented, and there's going to be an argument of medical necessity. Well, you didn't even do these other 4 tests. The problem is you got providers that are going to come back and say, hey, defensive medicine. Yeah. The policy doesn't say that I can't bill for these. The policy doesn't, you know, and I remember I had a case a bunch of years ago where the provider was billing, he billed for about 6 tests relative to a diagnosis of a heart murmur. And the industry will say that you only need one test to definitively show a heart murmur, and that's an ultrasound. And this provider did 4 or 5 other tests. And it was very hard to argue this, you know, that these are medically unnecessary tests. He's billing for a CPT or a HCPCS code that's a covered service, for a diagnosis that's a covered service. And while he's arguing, hey, defensive medicine, how do you argue these are medically unnecessary services when he's got a policy that shows an LCD or an NCD or a plan policy, a diagnosis that fits those, and the fact at the end of the day that there are 20 tests that are linked back to that diagnosis, right? So you never really get any of that when you read a press release. And then, you know, to get to your point, Matt, where there's a lot of data analytic driven cases that are coming up, everybody's going to look at that and go, holy cow, this provider is billing for all of these things that they shouldn't be. It must be services not rendered or something along those lines. So, you know, you got to take these things a little bit of a grain of salt to kind of figure out where that is. The other piece, Matt, is this whole premise of anomalies that come out, right? When we run data today, we're identifying providers that are aberrant in their behavior, which could or couldn't lead to a good case. And we know from Strikeforce, because we've all been involved with Strikeforce to some extent, is that the Strikeforce model is driven via data analytics and what we'll, I guess we'll say what it is, it's low-hanging fruit, right? And so you're looking to spin up a case very quickly on that low-hanging fruit. And sometimes the behavior is such where it is this issue involving a policy or something along those lines. And so, you know, getting back to what we talked about, is the juice worth the squeeze on those? So, you know, that becomes part of that metric. When you see that press release and you go, oh my God, this is terrible. Is it really as terrible as what the press release makes it seem?
Yeah, and there's all sorts of inside facts that you don't know, like with the anomalies that pop up. You know, this is the only provider in this area that bills this. It's well outside of his specialty, da-da-da-da-da. Well, then you do the investigation. You discover that the provider also has a subspecialty that is in line with what they're doing, or they're the only provider within 50 miles that could provide this service. And it explains those things away, but you don't know those things in looking at press releases, and you don't know those things just looking at the data.
Right. So wait, I want to go to you to kind of bring this all back and wrap it up. So for me, I look at press releases as what's the landscape of fraud, waste, and abuse today, right? Generating cases, because as I love to say, the circus never changes. It's just the clowns, right? Because you look at some of the frauds, right? You look at genetic testing fraud schemes. Those are, you know, or the telefraud schemes are the boiler room operations from DME and diabetic test strips of, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. What sort of value do you place in looking at press releases? And I know you don't spend a lot of time reading them because you're busy working on our SIU stuff, but what value do you see as being able to glean from a press release?
I think it's, again, I think there's two different ways to look at it. One is kind of looking at national press releases to see what the big picture is, what's the new fraud of the day type of thing. As it goes in like different cycles, you know, old DME cases with orthotics and things of that nature, they kind of disappeared for a while, or at least they were addressed and people were looking for other ways to make money. And those things come back, it's cyclical. So, you know, if you're looking at these press releases and, you know, wheelchairs were big in the 90s and then they kind of went away, they were coming back recently. So I think if you look at them nationally, it's valuable to kind of see the cyclical nature of it. But if you're looking at them specific to, if you're doing SIU work, you don't really care what's going on in California if you're sitting in New York, because it might be completely different. It's more regional. So I think if you look at it two different ways, one to get the bigger picture, just to see what's out there, what's coming back in, not in style, but what's being used again, reused again, as opposed to what might be a regional, you know, maybe in New York, there's a certain thing that's going on that's not in LA or in Texas or whatever. So I think if you look at it with that in mind, that there's really two different approaches to get value out of them, I think that that could be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, one of the things is you can always go up online. You can subscribe to press releases that come out of DOJ for particular districts. You can look at press releases that come nationally. So you can, you know, getting back to this whole premise of all fraud is local, you can certainly look at press releases that come from your respective geographic area and see what are the fraud trends that are coming about in kind of in your neck of the woods. You know, I tend to see that the press releases now are a lot more Fast and Furious. They come out pretty frequently, and they kind of just give you that 30,000 foot view. But if you're in an SIU, there's enough information for you to be able to take a look and see what's going on. And I think the, you know, the piece of the puzzle for me is if I see a press release from DOJ on a provider, you know, I want to look and see, is that provider, has that provider billed my plan for those things? You know, we're doing that within our SIU clients. We look at one provider, we see that they're an anomaly, and we bring that across to all of our other clients. While we're not necessarily aggregating the data, we're certainly looking at that provider across our book of business, right? To be able to see, like, what's the issue here? If there's one, if there's an issue in one, and you can get that from, you know, press releases will help you do that. You know, one way, if you're really a, if you're really a fraud geek and you want to really get into the weeds of what a case may have, you can always sign up for a PACER account. I know we talked about PACER as an investigative tool, but, you know, PACER is definitely a way to get a copy of the complaint. Anything that's been filed, particularly in a criminal case, anything that's been unsealed, you can get copies of those things and read them in PACER, which will then give you maybe another layer of kind of what that fraud scheme is. So I think there's a lot that can come out of press releases, but I think that everybody needs to just always be aware of the fact that oftentimes it is a starting point like anything else for an outsider looking in, and it certainly isn't the whole story. You've got to put other pieces to the puzzle. So the word of caution is that when you see a press release, people should not get into a panic that this provider did some terrible, terrible thing. I think that the DOJ and the Mofuku prosecutors and, you know, people out there whose job it is to do those levels of protection are making really hard and strong assessments about, you know, whether or not this is criminal and things of that sort. And we all know that when there is a case involving patient harm, those cases take absolute priority over everything else. We've all worked cases with patient harm, and we all know that the resources that the government will put forth to put a stop to a case in which there is an allegation of patient harm are going to be dealt with, you know, pretty rapidly. So I don't think that that people should take the position when they read a press release and necessarily take that strong stance, because there's a whole backstory that you just don't get to see. So keep reading press releases, though. I mean, it's a good source of information. For me, it's an investigative tool. If you're an SIU and you're looking for cases to generate, press releases are a great way, because you're going to be able to see what is going on outside of the world of your four corners to be able to identify future cases. So, as always, good topics to talk about. Thanks, everybody, as always, for tuning in. Thanks, as always, for supporting the OIG Roundtable. We look forward to continuing these conversations. As always, you can drop us a note, hello@advisehealth.com. Sign up for our newsletter, jump on our website. OIG Roundtables, LinkedIn Lives, all of that can be found on our website, Spotify, our YouTube channel. Super excited. We've got coming up our next LinkedIn Live. I'll be meeting with Stephen Bittinger. He and I are going to be talking about statistical sampling, overpayment estimation, the excitement of Chapter 8 of the PIM. We're going to talk about why statistical sampling is an important piece of the fraud, waste, abuse continuum, some of the areas that are concerning to everybody in there, particularly lawyers who fight them. And it's going to be an interesting conversation. I look forward to having that with Stephen. He's a great guy, good guy to talk to. So look forward to having you at that. Again, you can sign up for that on LinkedIn, and we look forward to seeing you guys on that, and look forward to seeing you at the next OIG Roundtable. Until next time, take care.
Thank you all.
Thank you.